Welcome. This is the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 1 to 11 by Bhikkhu Katakurunda Nyanananda, an e-learning course hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are ready for sermon number 7. But before that, a few points from the last lecture and sermon. The passage on the three sankharas and Hedwig Krenn pointing out that she thought that this was in particular in relation to the experience of cessation, the definition of the kaya sankhara, the bodily sankhara as breathing, etc. And the same point is also made by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his comments, in his annotation on the Samyutta Nikaya translation, page 728. He says, this triad of sankhara should not be confused with the triad discussed in Majjhima Nikaya 1, 301. This is the Chula Vedala Sutta. The latter triad is always introduced in relation to the cessation of perception and feeling, and is never brought into connection with dependent origination. And Venerable Dhammadina also commented on this, the importance of seeing that the formulation in the Vibhanga Sutta is not supported by the parallel. She says, it's just a detail after all, but this made me realize yet again how comparative studies have an extra gear that one truly knows of only when they become the default approach to the study and practice of early Buddhist texts. I was reminded of this explanation as I was reflecting that at times the conclusions one may reach by relying only on a single version of a challenging passage, and at times tirelessly trying to make sense of it, are by nature biased by the lack of the whole range of primary sources. I think this is a very important point. Now we'll come back to that before we get into the actual lecture. There was another comment by Kim Allen that I wanted to share. She said she was struck by the profundity of the dog thinking that it looks because the image is there, and when in fact it sees it only because it looks. Immediately a line from Adyashanti, admittedly another tradition, came to mind. You think that you resist things because they are there, but actually they are there because you resist them. For me, this clicked into place the notion of the glue of attachment, or equally of resistance, being the necessary ingredient to assemble fabrications. And then there was a comment on the reference to Sankhitena Panchupadana Kanda Dukkha, the five grasping groups are Dukkha, by Leonard. He says, what has always struck me in this is that in the Pali text, the word dukkha is used as an adjective, not a substantive, of which Venerable Bodhi's translation suggested. The phrase ix is dukkha, dukkha ish, does not express a mere identification, but a qualification. A qualification of the things or experiences mentioned in the formulation of the first satcha. So if we take the phrase panchupadana kanda dukkha, we could restate it informally as experience as a whole under clinging is dukkish. I found that very, very useful. There was also some discussion on the significance and scope of the five aggregates. And there was a comment by Robert. He said, I heard somewhere that the clinging aggregates are meant exemplary and that they simply comprise those elements which we often build our notion of a self on. So in this case, the clinging aggregates are considered from the perspective of anatta and not from the perspective of the whole of experience. I added whole there. Yeah, I think it's important that to see that the five aggregates are pointers to identification patterns. And so they do comprise the entire gamut of what we might be identifying with, but I don't think they are meant to provide a complete map of the type we get later in the Abhidhamma traditions. And this is significant in Sutra, as is particularly the aggregate of sankharas, which we have been talking about in the last sermon, is really has this very strong point towards volition and mental conditioning. And it is precisely out of the slightly misleading attempt in later tradition to turn the five aggregates into a complete map of the entire gamut of experience that this aggregate of formations of sankharas becomes a header under which any type of mental factor, whatever it is being included, and thereby it somehow loses its practical meaning. It becomes anything that is not feeling, perception or consciousness, all that goes under sankhara. And by trying to turn the five aggregates into a complete watertight map that comprises everything, the actual meaning somewhat gets lost. So these were the things I wanted to pick up from the last sermon before getting into the present one. And in line with what Venerable Dhammadina said about the importance of looking at the parallel versions, I just wanted to make a brief statement to provide a slight background to what I will be presenting in relation to Sermon 7. I said at the outset of Sermon 1 that I am deeply indebted to Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhikkhu Nyanananda for the guidance they have given me when I was still living in Sri Lanka. But after studying with them, I continued on my own to explore these parallel versions. And the image I like to use for that is somewhat like before I was looking with one eye. That was when I was just using the Pali discourses and under the guidance of these two eminent scholar monks. But after getting into the parallels, it was as if I was looking with both eyes. There's much of which is seen, which is similar, but the vision is a little broader, and also things in the center on the periphery are put into perspective. And so because of this somewhat default mode of looking at any passage from the viewpoint of the fact that this is the final product of a prolonged oral transmission, and it's always possible that there is an error or mistake in a particular line of transmission, be this the Pali or any other, and therefore as much as possible to look at the parallels, I sometimes have come to different conclusions, either differing with Bhikkhu Bodhi or with Bhikkhu Nyanananda. And in the present sermon, I will be presenting a different perspective on particularly what is the main topic of this Sermon 7, the Anidasana Vijnana, the non-manifestative consciousness. And I would just like to put on record that this is not in any way meant as a form of disrespect or lack of gratitude to Bhikkhu Kanyanananda or to Bhikkhu Bodhi when I disagree with him, but this is simply the perspective that emerges from taking into account the parallels. And I'm also not claiming that what I'm presenting is the final truth. It's simply this is how I see it, and this is the evidence on which I'm based, and anybody who listens to this or reads this when I publish something, they should take their own final conclusions based on what I have been presenting. And it is also not in any way a negative assessment of the profound knowledge and insight of these two eminent monks in relation to the teachings that we find in the Pali Canon. It's simply the fact is that when one has only one tradition to base one's reasoning on, it is bounded sometimes to lead into a different direction than when one has the more comprehensive survey of source material that is possible by considering the parallels. So this much for an introduction. Now we get into the actual sermon. Etang santang etang panitang yaridang sabba sankhara samato sabbo padipati nissaggo tanhankayo virago nirodho nibbanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor in the assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks. Towards the end of the last sermon, we happen to quote a certain verse from the Kivadda Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. The verse runs as follows. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham etta avocha patavi techo vayonam gadati etta digancha rasancha anunthulam subhasubham etta namancha rupancha asesam uparujyati Vijnanasya nirodhena ettitam uparujyati. Comment. Here is first the translation by Maurice Walsh. Your consciousness is signless, boundless, all-luminous. That's where earth, water, fire and air find no footing. They are both long and short, small and great, fair and foul. Their name and form are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. Now the Ceylonese, the Sri Lankan and the PTS edition have pahang instead of pabhang. The Pali English dictionary explains that paha has the sense of being accessible. And there's also the comment that it is not at all improbable to take pahang as from pajahati. Pajahang, meaning giving up entirely. And I've also put here the in entry by Monia Williams on the related Pradha. Now, in Maurice Walsh's translation, which I just quoted, he follows Pabhang, but pretty much all other translators that follow Pahang. This is the case for Rice Davids, and also for the two German translations by Neumann and Franke. Then the passage in question has been studied in detail by Kerr Norman in an article, and he, based on examining the commentary explanations by Buddha Gosa, comes to the conclusion that an earlier version, perhaps the earliest version of the epithet, had the form sabbato paha. I'm not going to read all of this. It's just for those of you who want to follow it up. And he thinks that the Pahang found in the present PTS edition and Sinhalese edition is not a remnant of what he thinks is the earliest one, but could simply be a scribal error. But so what comes up from what I have presented so far is simply that there is much more support. The translators, and based on the commentary, it seems there is quite a number of scholars who think Pahang is more probable than Pabhang. And this is also what emerges from considering the parallels. Here, first I have the Sanskrit fragment parallel, and the reading supports Pahang. Then there is the Tibetan parallel. It also supports Pahang. And it also has a reference to cessation at the beginning of the quote, which is a little puzzling, but it's interesting when we come to the Chinese parallels. The Chinese Diaga Agama actually has pabhang, it has luminosity. However, it says that in relation to this luminous consciousness, that it is the cessation of that consciousness, which brings about the cessation of the four elements. So it has a very, very different sense from the Pali, even though it is the only version that actually follows the Pabhang, the sense of luminosity, instead of Pahang, which could either mean some sort of like spread out accessibility or giving up, letting go. Then we have a quote in the Mahavibhasha, a sutra quote, and it also supports Pahang. And then we have quotations in the Ratnavali in Tibetan and Chinese, and these also do not have the notion of luminosity. So what emerges from the parallel version, as a summary, the sense of luminosity, Bhabhang, is probably due to a later change. A presumably more original reading of Pahang, at times understood to convey nuances of accessibility or of being spread out, could also be a reference to the cessation of consciousness. In fact, the only version, the Dirga Agama in Chinese, that supports the sense of luminosity follows this right away with a reference to the cessation of such a luminous consciousness as the condition for the cessation of the four elements. The Tibetan also has a reference to cessation in the part immediately preceding the line in question. End of comment. The other day we could give only a general idea of the meaning of this verse in brief, because of the question of time. Today we propose to attempt a detailed explanation of it. To start with, we purposely avoid rendering the first two lines, which appear as the crux of the whole verse. Taking those two lines as they are, we could paraphrase this verse as follows. It is in a consciousness that is anidassana, ananta and sabbatopabha that earth, water, fire and air do not find a footing. It is in this consciousness that long and short, fine and coarse, and pleasant and unpleasant, as well as name and form, are kept in check. It is by the cessation of consciousness that all these are held in check. Let us not try to sort out the meaning of the difficult words in the first two lines. First of all, in the expression vijnanam anidassanam, there is the term anidassanas. The meaning of the word nidassana is fairly well known. It means illustration. Something that throws light on or makes clear is called nidassana. This is the basic sense. We find an instance of the use of this word, even in this basic sense, in the first Kosala Sutta among the tens of the Anguttara Nikaya. It is in connection with the description of Abhibhayatana, basis of mastery, where there is a reference to contemplation devices known as kasina. It is said that even the flax flower can be used initially as a sign for kasina meditation. A flax flower is described in the following words. Umma puppang nilang nilavannang nilanidassanang nilanibhasang, which may be rendered as the flax flower, blue, blue-colored, manifesting blue, shining blue. Nilanidassanang suggests that the flax flower is an illustration of blue color, or that it is a manifestation of blue. Anidassana could therefore be said to refer to whatever does not manifest anything. In fact, we have a very good example in support of this suggested sense in the Kakachupama Sutta of the Manjima Nikaya. There we find the Buddha putting a certain question to the monks in order to bring out a simile. Monks, suppose a man comes with crimson, turmeric, indigo or carmine and says, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on the sky. What do you think, monks? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear there? Then the monks reply, Ayanhi bhante akasu arupi anidassano. Tattha na sukarang rupang likhitung rupa patu bhavang katung. This sky, Lord, is immaterial and non-illustrative. It is not easy to draw a picture there or make manifest pictures there. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli. Suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo or carmine and said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, bhikkhus? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space? No, Venerable Sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and non-manifestative. It is not easy to draw pictures there or make pictures appear there. And here, translation of the Madhyama Agama parallel. It is just as if a painter or a painter's apprentice were to come along carrying various colors and say, I will trace forms and images in empty space and adorn them with these colored paints. What do you think? Will that painter or that painter's apprentice be able, by this means, to trace forms and images in empty space and adorn them with colored paints? The monks replied, No, Blessed One. Why is that? Blessed One, empty space is non-material, invisible and without resistance. Therefore that painter or that painter's apprentice is not able by this means to trace forms and images in empty space and adorn them with colored paints. Then I also wanted to give some additional information on Anidasana. Peter Harvey, in his discussion of the Anidasana Vijnana, has pointed out that this is one of the epithets of Nibbana in the Asankata Samyutta. And I find it significant that the Samyukta Agama Pal does not include Anidasana in its list of epithets of Nibbana. End of comment. Here we have the words in support of the above suggested meaning. The sky is said to be Arupi Anidasana, immaterial and non-illustrative. That is why one cannot draw pictures there or make pictures appear there. There is nothing material in the sky to make manifest pictures. That is, the sense in which it is called Anidasana in this context. Let us now see how meaningful that word is when used with reference to consciousness as Vijnanam Anidasana. While the sky is said to be non-manifestative, we could easily understand by the simile. But how can consciousness become non-manifestative? First and foremost, we can remind ourselves of the fact that our consciousness has in it the ability to reflect. That ability is called paccavekkhana, looking back. Sometimes the Buddha has given the simile of the mirror with reference to this ability, as for instance in the Ambalattika Rahulovada Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. In the Ananda Sutta of the Khanda Samyutta, also he has used the simile of the mirror. In the former sutta preached to the Venerable Rahula, the Buddha uses the simile of the mirror to stress the importance of reflection in regard to bodily, verbal and mental action. In our last sermon, we gave a simile of a dog crossing a plank over a stream and looking at its own reflection in the water. That too is a kind of reflection. But from that we can deduce a certain principle with regard to the question of reflection, namely, that the word stands for a mode of becoming deluded as well as a mode of getting rid of the delusion. What creates a delusion is the way that dog is repeatedly looking down from his own point of view on the plank to see a dog in the water. That is unwise reflection born of non-radical attention, ayonisu manasikara. Under the influence of the personality view, sakkaya ditti, it goes on looking at its own image, wagging its tail and growling. But wise reflection born of radical attention, yoniso manasikara, is what is recommended in the Ambalattika Rahulovada Sutta with its thematic repetitive phrase paccavekkhitvā paccavekkhitvā, reflecting again and again. Wise reflection inculcates the Dhamma point of view. Reflection based on right view, sammaditti, leads to deliverance. So this is the twin aspect of reflection. But this we mention by the way. The point we wish to stress is that consciousness has in it the nature of reflecting something, like a mirror. Now Vijnanam Anidasanam is a reference to the nature of the released consciousness of an arahant. It does not reflect anything. To be more precise, it does not reflect a nama-rupa, or name and form. An ordinary individual sees a nama-rupa when he reflects, which he calls I and mine. It is like the reflection of that dog, which sees its own delusive reflection in the water. A non-arahant upon reflection sees name and form, which however he mistakes to be his self. With the notion of I and mine, he falls into delusion with regard to it. But the Arahant's consciousness is an unestablished consciousness. We have already mentioned in previous sermons about the established consciousness and the unestablished consciousness. A non-Arahant's consciousness is established on name and form. The unestablished consciousness is that which is free from name and form and is unestablished on name and form. The established consciousness upon reflection reflects name and form on which it is established, whereas the unestablished consciousness does not find a name and form as a reality. The Arahant has no attachments or entanglements in regard to name and form. In short, it is a sort of penetration of name and form without getting entangled in it. This is how we have to unravel the meaning of the expression anilasana vijnana. By way of further clarification of the sense of anilasana, we may remind ourselves of the fact that manifestation requires something material. That is obvious even from that simile picked up at random from the Kakachupama Sutta. As for the consciousness of the Arahant, the verse in question makes it clear that earth, water, fire and air do not find a footing there. It is because of these four great primaries that one gets the perception of form. They are said to be the cause and condition for the designation of the aggregate of form. Chattaro ko bhikkhu mahabhuta hetu chattaro mahabhuta paccayo rupam khandhasya panyapanaya. The four great primaries, monk, are the cause and condition for the designation of the form group. Now the Arahant has freed his mind from these four elements. As it is said in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Patavi Dhatuya Chittang Virajati, he makes his mind dispassionate with regard to the earth element. Apo Dhatuya Chittang Virajati, he makes his mind dispassionate with regard to the water element. As he has freed his mind from the four elements through disenchantment, which makes them fade away, the Arahant's reflection does not engender a perception of form. As the verse in question puts it rather rhetorically, Etta apocha patavi techo vayona gadhati. Herein, water and earth, fire and air find no footing. Here the word gadhati is particularly significant. When, for instance, we want to plumb the depth of a deep well, we lower something material as a plumb into the well. Where it comes to stay, we take as the bottom. In the consciousness of the Arahant, the material elements cannot find such a footing. They cannot manifest themselves in that unplumbed depth of the Arahant's consciousness. Vijnanam anilasanam anantam sambhatupabhang etta apo cha patavi techo vayona gadhati. Consciousness, which is non-manifestative, endless and lustrous on all sides, it is here that water, earth, fire and air no footing find. It is precisely because material elements cannot make themselves manifest in it that this consciousness is called non-manifestative. In the same connection, we may add that such distinctions as long and short, fine and coarse, and pleasant and unpleasant are not registered in that consciousness because they pertain to things material. When the consciousness is freed from the four elements, it is also free from the relative distinctions, which are but the standards of measurements proper to those elements. Let us now consider the implications of the term anantam, endless, infinite. We have already said something about the plumbing of the depth of waters. Since the material elements have faded away in that consciousness, they are unable to plumb its depth. They no longer serve as an index to that consciousness. Therefore, that consciousness is endless or infinite. It is endless also in another sense. With regard to such distinctions as long and short, we use the word relative. These are relative concepts. We even refer to them as conjoined pairs of terms. In worldly usage, they are found conjoined as long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant and unpleasant. There is a dichotomy about these concepts. There is a bifurcation. It is as if they are put within a rigid framework. When, for instance, we go searching for a piece of wood for some purpose or other, we may say, "This piece of wood is too long." Why do we say so? Because we are in need of a shorter one. Instead of saying that it is not sufficiently short, we say it is too long. When we say it is too short, what we mean is that it is not sufficiently long. So then, long and short are relevant within one framework. As a matter of fact, all measurements are relative to some scale or other. They are meaningful within some framework of a scale. In this sense, too, the worldling's way of thinking has a tendency to go to extremes. It goes to one extreme or the other. When it was said that the world, for the most part, rests on a dichotomy, such as that between the two views is and is not, this idea of a framework is already implicit. The worldling's way of thought end up in one extreme or the other within this framework. The Arahant transcends it. His consciousness is therefore endless, ananta. There is a verse in the Patali Dhammiya Vagga of the Uddana which clearly brings out this fact. Most of the discourses in that section of the Uddana deal with Nibbana, Nibbana Patisamyata. And the following verse too is found in such a discourse. Duddhasan anantang nama nahi sachang sudassanam patividdhatanha janatum pasato nanti kinchanam. Common. Translation by Ireland. The unaffected is hard to see. The truth is not easy to see. Craving is penetrated by one who knows. There is no obstruction for one who sees. The Burmese, the Ceylonese, and the Siamese edition read anattang, and the PTS edition reads anattang. So the reading anantang is only found as a variant, but not in any of the four editions. And the Chinese parallel, I have translated this here, difficult to see is the truth which is immovable. While contemplating and discerning it, one will observe the destruction of craving at its source. This is reckoned to be the end of dukkha. So the Chinese parallel also has no counterpart to ananta, ananta. And the corresponding term seems to be rather anenja, or perhaps it could be a misunderstanding of anatta, of bent, becoming immovable. So I think this is less probable. In sum, the main editions of the present passage and its Chinese parallel do not offer support for considering ananta, endless, to be an epithet of Nibbana. End of comment. This verse, like many other deep ones, seems to have puzzled the commentators. Let alone the meaning, even the variant readings have posed them a problem, so much so that they end up giving the reader a choice between alternate interpretations. But let us try to get at the general trend of its meaning. Duddhasan anantang nama. Hard to see is the endless, whatever that endless be. Nahi sachang sudassanam. The truth is not easily seen. Which in effect is an emphatic assertion of the same idea. One could easily guess that this endless is the truth and that it refers to Nibbana. Patividdha tanha means that craving has been penetrated through. This penetration is through knowledge and wisdom, the outcome of which is stated in the last line, Janato pasato nanti kinchanam. To one who knows and sees, there is nothing. The idea is that when craving is penetrated through with knowledge and wisdom, one realizes the voidness of the world. Obviously, the reference here is to Nibbana. The entire verse may now be rendered as follows. Hard to see is the endless, not easily it is to see the truth. Pierced through is craving, and not for him who knows and sees. The commentator, however, is at a loss to determine whether the correct reading is anantang, anatang, or anantang, and leaves the question open. He gives one interpretation in favor of the reading anatang. To choose justifiability, he says that nata is a synonym for tanha or craving, and that anatang is a term for nibbana, in the sense there is no craving in it. It must be pointed out that it is nati and not nata that is used as a synonym for tanha. Anyway, after adducing reasons for the acceptability of the reading anatang, he goes on to say that there is a variant reading anantang, and gives an interpretation in support of it too. In fact, he interprets the word anantang in more than one sense. Firstly, because Nibbana is permanent, it has no end. And secondly, it is endless because it is immeasurable or apamana. In our interpretation of the word anantang, we have not taken it in the sense of permanence or everlastingness. The word apamana or immeasurable can have various nuances. But the one we have stressed is the transcendence of relative concepts, limited by their dichotomous nature. We have also alluded to the unplumbed depth of the Arahant's consciousness, in which the four elements do not find a footing. In the Buddha Vagga of the Dhammapada, we come across another verse, which highlights the extraordinary significance of the word Anantam. Yasa jalini visattika tanha natthi kohinchinitave tang buddham ananta gocharam aparang kena padena nesata. Comment, translation by Norman. Of whom there is no attachment with the net or craving to lead him anywhere, him awakened with endless track. Leaving no track, by what track will you lead him? End of comment. Before attempting a translation of this verse, some of the words in it have to be commented upon. Yasa jalini visattika. Jalini is a synonym for craving. It means one who has a net or one who goes netting. Visattika refers to the agglutinative character of craving. It keeps whirling glued to objects of sense. The verse may be rendered as follows. He who has no craving, with nets in and agglutinates to lead him somewhere. By what track could that awakened one of infinite range be led, trackless as he is? Because the Buddha is of infinite range, he is trackless. His path cannot be traced. Craving wields the net of name and form with its glue when it goes ranging. But since the awakened one has the endless as his range, there is no track to trace him by. The term Ananta Gocharang means one whose range has no end or limit. If, for instance, one chases a deer, to catch it, one might succeed at least at the end of the pasture. But the Buddha's range is endless, and his ranging leaves no track. The commentators seem to interpret this term as a reference to the Buddha's omniscience, to his ability to attend to an infinite number of objects. But this is not the sense in which we interpret the term here. The very fact that there is no object makes the Buddha's range endless and untraceable. Had there been an object, craving could have netted him in. In support of this interpretation, we may allude to the following couple of verses in the Arahantavanga of the Dhammapada. Yesang sannicca yo natthi ye parinyata bhojana sunyato animitto cha vimokkho yesa gocharo akase vasa kuntanam gati tisam durannaya yassasava parikhina ahare cha anissito sunyato animitto sva vimokkho yasa gocharo akase vasa kuntanam param tassa durannaya. Translation by K. N. Norman. Comment. Of whom there is no accumulation, who have knowledge of and have renounced food, whose realm is empty and unconditioned release, their going is hard to follow, like that of birds in the sky, whose asavas are destroyed and who is not dependent upon food, whose realm is empty and unconditioned release, his track is hard to follow, like that of birds in the sky. End of comment. Both verses express more or less the same idea. Let us examine the meaning of the first verse. The first two lines are Yesang sannichayo natanti ye parinyata bhojana. Those who have no accumulation and who have comprehended their food. The words used here are charged with deep meanings. Verses in the Dhammapada are very often rich in imagery. The Buddha has on many occasions presented the Dhamma through deep similes and metaphors. If the metaphorical sense of a term is ignored, one can easily miss the point. For instance, the word sannicaya in this context, which we have rendered as accumulation, is suggestive of the heaping up of the five aggregates. The word upacaya is sometimes used with reference to this process of heaping up that goes on in the minds of the worldlings. Now this heaping up, as well as the accumulation of karma, is not there in the case of an arahant. Also, they have comprehended their food. The comprehension of food does not mean simply the usual reflection on food in terms of elements. nor does it imply just one kind of food, but all the four nutriments mentioned in the Dhamma, namely Kabalinkarahara, material food, Pasa, contact, Manu Sanchetana, volition, and Vijnana, consciousness. The next two lines tell us what the true range or pasture of the Arahant is. It is an echo of the idea of comprehension of food, as well as the absence of accumulation. Sunyato animito cha vimokko yesu gocharum, whose range is the deliverance of the void and the signless. When the Arahants are in their attainment to the fruit of Arahanthood, their minds turn towards the void and the signless. When they are on this feeding ground, neither Mara nor craving can catch them with their nets. They are trackless. Hence the last two lines, Akaseva sakuntanam gati tisa durannaya. Their track is hard to trace, like that of birds in the sky. The word gati in this last line is interpreted by the commentators as a reference to the whereabouts of the Arahants after their parinibbana. It is dubious associations of some place as a destination. But in this context, gati does not lend itself to such an interpretation. It only refers to their mental compass, which is untraceable, because of their deliverance to the void and the signless. The next verse also brings out this idea. Yas asava parikinkina aharecha anisito, whose influxes are extinct and who is unattached in regard to nutriment. Sunyato animito cha vimokko yasa gocharo, whose range is the void and the signless. Akaseva sakuntanan padang tasa duranaya. His path is hard to trace, like that of birds in the sky. This reminds us of the last line of the verse quoted earlier. Apadam kena padena nesata. By what track could one lead him who is trackless? These two verses then throw more light on the meaning of the expression Ananta Gochara, of infinite range, used as an epithet for the awakened one. Let us now get at the meaning of the term Sabbatupabhang in the context Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbatupabhang. In our discussion of the significance of the drama and the cinema, we mentioned that it is the darkness in the background which keeps the audience entranced, in a way that they identify themselves with the characters and react accordingly. The darkness in the background throws a spell of delusion. That is what makes for enjoyment. Of course, there is some sort of light in the cinema hall, but that is very limited. Sometimes it is only a beam of light directed on the screen. In a previous sermon, we happened to mention that even in the case of a matinee show, dark curtains and closed doors and windows ensure the necessary dark background. Here in this simile, we have a clue to the meaning sabbatupabhang, luminous or lustrous on all sides. Suppose a matinee show is going on and one is enjoying it, entranced and deluded by it. Suddenly doors and windows are flung open and the dark curtains are removed. Then immediately one slips out of the cinema world. The film may go on, but because of the light coming from all sides, the limited illumination on the screen fades away before the total illumination. The film thereby loses its enjoyable quality. As far as consciousness or vijnana is concerned, it is not something completely different from wisdom, panya, as it is defined in the Mahavidala Sutta. However, there is also a difference between them. Panya bhavitabha vijnanam parinyayam. Wisdom is to be developed, consciousness is to be comprehended. It is said that one has to comprehend the nature of consciousness. Comment: the Chinese and Tibetan parallels do not have this particular statement. End of comment. Then one may ask, we are understanding everything with consciousness, so how can one understand consciousness? But the Buddha has shown us the way of doing it. Wisdom, when it is developed, enables one to comprehend consciousness. In short, consciousness is as narrow as that beam of light falling on the cinema screen. That is to say, the specifically prepared consciousness, or the consciousness crammed up in name and form, as in the case of the non-arahant. It is as narrow as the perspective of the audience glued to the screen. The consciousness of the ordinary whirling is likewise limited and committed. Now what happens when it is fully illuminated on all sides with wisdom? It becomes sabbato pabhang, lustrous on all sides. In that luster, which comes from all sides, the framework of ignorance fades away. It is that released consciousness, free from the dark framework of ignorance, that is called the consciousness which is lustrous on all sides, in that cryptic verse in question. This luster, associated with wisdom, has a special significance according to the discourses. In the Chatukkanipata of the Anguttara Nikaya, we come across the following sutta. Chattasvima bhikkhave pabha, katama chattasva, chanda pabha, surya pabha, agi pabha, panya pabha. Imako bhikkhave chattasva pabha. Etat aggang bhikkhave immasang chattumnam pabhanam yadidang panya pabha. Monks, there are these four lustres. Which four? The lustre of the moon, the lustre of the sun, the lustre of fire, and the lustre of wisdom. These monks are the four lustres. This monk is the highest among these four lustres, namely the lustre of wisdom. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Because they are these four splendors. What for? The splendor of the moon, the splendor of the sun, the splendor of fire, and the splendor of wisdom. These are the four splendors. Of these four splendors, the splendor of wisdom is foremost. No parallel is known to this discourse to me. End of comment. Another important discourse, quoted quite often, though not always correctly interpreted, is the following. Pabhasarang idam bhikkhave cittam, tancha ko agantuke upakilise upakilittam, tanga suttava puthujjano yatha bhutam na bhujanati, tasma asuttavato puthujjana sa citta bhavana nanditi vadami. Pabhasarang idam bhikkhave cittam, tancha ko agantuke upakilise vipamuttam, tang suttava arya savako yatha bhutam bhujanati, tasma sutavato arya savakasya citta bhavana atiti vadami. This mind, monks, is luminous, but it is defiled by extraneous defilements that the uninstructed, ordinary man does not understand as it is. Therefore, there is no mind development for the ordinary man, I declare. This mind, monks, is luminous, but it is released from extraneous defilements that the uninstructed noble disciple understands as it is. Therefore, there is mind development for the instructed noble disciple, I declare. Comment. Translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Luminous because is this mind, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. The uninstructed worldling does not understand this as it really is. Therefore, I say that for the uninstructed worldling, there is no development of the mind. Luminous because is this mind, but it is freed from adventitious defilements. The instructed noble disciple understands this as it really is. Therefore I say that for the instructed noble disciple there is development of the mind. A comment by Karunaratna from the Encyclopedia of Buddhism. What is meant by lustrous and pure mind, Pabhasara, is not a state of mind which is absolutely pure, nor the pure mind which is synonymous with emancipation. Pure only in the sense and to the extent that it is not disturbed or influenced by external stimuli. And another comment by Shi Wen Yan in a study on the pure mind. The explanation is, unlike the Mahayana theory of Tathagata Garba, which claims that the innately pure mind possesses all the virtues of the Buddha, and that the revelation of this mind is the attainment of the Buddhahood, statements in the Pali texts only emphasize the knowledge of the innate purity of the mind as a prerequisite step in the cultivation of the mind. And the restoration of the purity of the mind is not the end of religious practices. As a matter of fact, after the removal of the defilements, the mind is not only pure, tranquil and luminous, but also soft, pliant and adaptable. It then becomes suitable for the destruction of all the asavas, or the cultivation of the seven limbs of wisdom and the like. This means that the tranquil, luminous and pliable mind is just the basis for further religious practice. End of comment. It is sufficiently clear then that the allusion is to the luminous mind, the consciousness of the Arahant, which is non-manifestative, infinite and all lustrous. To revert to the analogy of the cinema, which, at least in a limited sense, helps us to form an idea about it, we have spoken about the stilling of all preparations. Now in the case of the film, too, there is a stilling of preparations. That is to say, the preparations which go to make it a movie film are stilled. The multicolored dresses of actors and actresses become colorless before that illumination, even in the case of a technicolor film. The scenes on the screen get blurred before the light that suddenly envelops them. And what is the outcome of it? The preparations going on in the minds of the audience, whether induced by the film producers or aroused from within, are calmed down at least temporarily. This symbolizes, in a limited sense, the significance of the phrase sabbasankhara samatha, the stilling of all preparations. Then, what about the relinquishment of all assets, sabbupadipatinissangha? In the context of the film show, it is the bundle of experiences coming out of one's vested interests in the marvelous cinema world. These assets are relinquished at least for the moment. Destruction of craving, tanhakkayo, is momentarily experienced with regard to the blurred scenes on the screen. As to the term viraga, we have already shown that it can be understood in two senses, that is, dispassion as well as the fading away, which brings about the dispassion. Now in this case too, the fading away occurred, not by any other means, but by the very fact that the limited narrow beam of consciousness got superseded by the unlimited light of wisdom. Nirodha means cessation, and the film has now ceased to be a film, though the machines are still active. We have already mentioned that in the last analysis, a film is produced by the audience. So its cessation, too, is a matter for the audience. This, then, is the cessation of the film. Now comes Nibbana, extinction or extinguishment. Whatever heated emotions and delirious excitements that arose out of the film show cooled down, at least momentarily, when the illumination takes over. This way we can form some idea, somewhat inferentially, about the meaning and significance of the term sambhato pabhang, with the help of this illustration based on the film show. So now we have tackled most of the difficulties to the interpretation of this verse. In fact, it is the few words occurring in the first two lines that has posed an insoluble problem to scholars both Eastern and Western. We have not yet given the commentary interpretation, and that not out of disrespect for the venerable commentators. It is because the interpretation is rather hazy and inconclusive. However, we shall be presenting that interpretation at the end of this discussion, so as to give the reader an opportunity to compare it with ours. But for the present, let us proceed to say something about the last two lines as well. Vijnanasa nirodhena ettitam uparujyati. As we saw above, for all practical purposes, name and form seem to cease, even like the fading away of the scenes on the cinema screen. Then what is meant by this phrase vijnanasa nirodhena, with the cessation of consciousness? The reference here is to that abhisankata vijnana, or the specifically prepared consciousness. It is the cessation of that concocted type of consciousness which was formerly there, like the one directed on the cinema screen by the audience. With the cessation of that specifically prepared consciousness, all constituents of name and form are said to be held in check, uparujyati. Here too we have a little problem. Generally, nirujyati and uparujyati are regarded as synonyms. The way these two verbs are used in some suttas would even suggest that they mean the same thing. As a matter of fact, even the Chula Nidesa, which is a very old commentary, paraphrases uparujyati by nirujyati. Uparujyati iti nirujyati. Nevertheless, in the context of this particular verse, there seems to be something deep involved in the distinction between these two verbs. Even at a glance, the two lines in question are suggestive of some distinction between them. Comment. I understand why Venerable Jnanananda, based on only having the Pali version at his disposition, distinguishes between two types of vijnana here, and also distinguishes between uparujati and nirujati. But as I showed in the earlier part of the lecture, based on the parallel versions, it seems fairly clear that the reading Pabhang is not an original reading. And when we let go of Pabhang, the verse becomes a little bit clearer and the contrast doesn't become as strong as it seems to be with the reading Pabhang, the luminosity. And an Abhisankata Vijnana is not a term that I'm used to from the suttas. So I'm not sure how far it helps to bring in such an idea. And according to Uparujati and Nirujati, as I have shown here, the whole verse is based on lines with 8 syllables. And so, because Uparujati has 5 syllables and Nirujati has 4 syllables, there is a very straightforward reason for choosing the one term or the other, namely simply to make up the line of 8 syllables in a poem. And I had contacted Bhikkhu Ananda Jyoti, who is a specialist on poem and Pali meter, to get his opinion on this point. And his comment is, the commentary doesn't seem to have any doubt. Uparujati ti nirujati kim agamma asesam etam appavattati ti. Of course, nirujati is passive and uparujati is active, so there's a slight change of tone. But it does seem to me it is probably just a matter of meeting the shloka requirements. End of comment. Vijnanasa nirodhena etitam uparujati. The niroda of consciousness is said to result in the uparuda of whatever constitutes name and form. This is intriguing enough. But that is not all. By way of preparing the background for the discussion, we have already made a brief allusion to the circumstances in which the Buddha uttered this verse. What provided the context for its utterance was a riddle that occurred to a certain monk in a moment of fancy. The riddle was, where do these 4 great primaries cease altogether? There the verb used is nirujjanti. So in order to find where they cease, he whimsically went from heaven to heaven and from Brahma world to Brahma world. As we mentioned earlier too, it was when the Mahabrahma directed that monk to the Buddha, saying, why on earth did you come all this way when the Buddha is there to ask? That the Buddha reworded the question. He pointed out that the question was incorrectly worded and revised it as follows before venturing to answer it. Katta apocha patavi techo vayana gadhati katta digancha rasancha anung tulang subhasubham katta namancha rupancha asesan uparujjati. The word used by the Buddha in this revised version is uparujjati and not nirujjati. Yet another innovation is the use of the term nagadati. Where do water, earth, fire and air find no footing? Or where do they not get established? In short, here is a word suggestive of plumbing the depth of a reservoir. We may hark back to the simile given earlier concerning the plumbing of the consciousness with the perception of form. Where do the 4 elements not find a footing? Also, where are such relative distinctions as long and short, subtle and cross, pleasant and unpleasant, as well as name and form, completely held in check? In this restatement of the riddle, the Buddha has purposely avoided the use of the verb nirujjati. Instead, he had recourse to such terms as nagadati, does not find a footing, does not plumb, and uparujjati, is held in check, or is cut off. This is evidence enough to infer that there is a subtle distinction between the nuances associated with the 2 verbs nirujjati and uparujjati. What is the secret behind this peculiar usage? The problem that occurred to this monk is actually of the type that the materialists of today conceive of. It is in itself a fallacy. To say that the 4 elements cease somewhere in the world or in the universe is a contradiction in terms. Why? Because the very question, where do they cease, presupposes an answer in terms of those elements by way of defining that place. This is the kind of uncouth question an ordinary materially inclined person would ask. That is why the Buddha reformulated the question, saying, "Monks, that is not the way to put the question. You should not ask where the four great primary sees, but rather where they, as well as the concepts of long and short, subtle and cross, pleasant and unpleasant, and name and form, are held in check. The question proper is not where the four great primary sees, but where they do not get established, and where all their accompaniments are held in check." Here then we see the Buddha relating the concept of metta, which the world takes for granted, to the perception of form arising in the mind. The four great primaries haunt the mind of the worldlings like ghosts, though they have to be exorcised from their minds. It is not a question of expelling them from this world or from any heavenly realm or the entire world system. That exorcism should take place in this very consciousness, so as to put an end to this haunting. Before the light of wisdom, those ghosts, namely the four great primaries, become ineffective. It is in the darkness of ignorance that these ghosts haunt the worldlings with the perception of form. They keep the minds of the worldlings bound, glued, committed, and limited. What happens now is that the specifically prepared consciousness, which was bound, glued, committed, and limited, becomes fully released, due to the light of wisdom, to become non-manifestative, endless, and lustrous on all sides. To sum up, we may render the verse in question as follows. Consciousness which is non-manifestative, endless, lustrous on all sides, here it is that earth and water, fire and air, no footing find. Here it is that long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant and unpleasant, and name and form are cut off without exception. When consciousness has surceased, these are held in check herein. Though we venture to translate the verse, we have not yet given the commentary or interpretation of it. Since this might seem a shortcoming, we shall now present what the commentator has to say on this verse. Venerable Buddha Ghosa, before coming to this verse in his commentary to the Kevadatta Sutta, gives an explanation as to why the Buddha reformulated the original question of that monk. According to him, the question, "Where do the four great primaries cease?" implied both the organic and the inorganic aspects of matter. And in revising it, the Buddha limited its scope to the organic. In other words, Venerable Buddha Ghosa presumes that the revised version has to be interpreted with reference to this human body. Hence he explains such words as long and short, occurring in the verse, in a limited sense, as referring to the body's stature. How facile this interpretation turns out to be, one can easily discern as we go on. Venerable Buddha Ghosa keeps on reminding the reader that the questions are relevant only to the organic realm. Upadinnam eva sandhaya pucchati. So he interprets the term dighancha rasrancha, long and short, as relative distinctions of a person's height, that is, tallness and shortness. Similarly, the words anung tulang, subtle and cross, are said to mean the small and big in the size of the body. Likewise, subha and asubha are taken to refer to the comely and the ugly in terms of body's experience, appearance. The explanation given to the phrase namancha rupancha is the most astounding of all. Nama is said to be the name of the person, and rupa is his form or shape. All this goes to show that the commentator has gone off at a tangent, even in the interpretation of this verse, which is more or less the prologue to such an intricate verse as the one in question. He has blundered at the very outset in limiting the scope of those relative terms to the organic, thereby obscuring the meaning of that deep verse. The significance of these relative terms, from the linguistic point of view, has been overlooked. Words like digang rasang and anung tulang do not refer to the stature and size of some person. What they convey is the dichotomous nature of concepts in the world. All those deep implications are obscured by the reference to a person's outward appearance. The confusion becomes worse confounded when namancha rupancha is interpreted as the name and the shape of a person. So the stage is already set for a shallow interpretation, even before presenting the verse beginning with vijnana anidasana, It is on such an unsound premise that the commentator bases his interpretation of the verse in question. We shall try to do justice to that exposition too. It might necessitate a fair amount of quotations, though it is difficult to be comprehensive in this respect. The commentator begins his exposition with the word vijnani itself. He comes up with a peculiar etymology. Vijnananti tata vijnatabhanti vijnana nibbanasya nama, which means that the word vijnana, or consciousness, is in this context a synonym for nibbana, in the sense that it is to be known, vijnatabhanti. This forced etymology is far from convincing, since such a usage is not attested elsewhere. Moreover, we come across a long list of epithets for Nibbana, as many as 33, in the Asankata Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, but Vijnana is not counted as one. In fact, nowhere in the discourses is Vijnana used as a synonym for Nibbana. Next, he takes up the word Anidassana and makes the following comment. Tattetam nidassana bhavato anidassana. That Nibbana is called anidassana because no illustration for it could be given. The idea is that it has nothing to compare with. Then comes the word, the explanation of the word anantam. According to the commentator, Nibbana is called ananta, endless, because it has neither the arising end, upada anto, nor the falling end, vaya anto, nor the otherwiseness of the persisting end, tittas anyattata. Strangely enough, even the last mentioned middle end is counted as an end. Strangely enough, even the last mentioned middle state is counted as an end in the commentator's concept of three ends. So this is the substance of this commentary to the first three words, vijnanam, anidassanam, anantam. The commentarial interpretation of the term sabbatopabhang is even more confusing. The word pabha is explained as a synonym for papa, meaning food. The bha element in the word, he explains, is a result of consonantal interchange with the original pa and papa. Pakarasapana bhakarokato. The idea is that the original form of this particular form term for nibbana is sabbato papan. The meaning attributed to it is with folds on all sides. Nibbana is supposed to be metaphorically conceived as the ocean, to get down into which there are folds on all sides, namely the 38 topics of meditation. This interpretation seems rather far-fetched. It is as if the commentator has resorted to this simile of a fold, because he is already in deep waters. The word pabha, as it is, clearly means light or radiance, and its association with wisdom is also well attested in the canon. Comment, I earlier mentioned the article by K. R. Norman, the bibliographical references are at the end of the lecture script, and K. R. Norman instead takes the commentarial explanation to reflect the fact that the actual reading that they knew of was not yet with the word pabha. End of comment. Though in his commentary to the Digha Nikaya, Venerable Dagosa advances the above interpretation, in his commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, he seems to have had second thoughts on the problem. In the Brahmanimantanika Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya also, the first two lines of the verse Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbatopabhang occur. But here the commentator follows a different line of interpretation. Whereas in his commentary to the Kivadanta Sutta, he explains Anidassanam as an epithet of Nibbana, in the sense of having nothing to compare with. Here he takes it in the sense of not being visible to the eyes. Chakkavijnanasya apātam anupagamanato anidassanam nama. It is called anidassana because it does not come within the range of eye consciousness. In explaining the term sabbatopabham, he suggests several alternative interpretations. In the first interpretation, he takes pabha to mean light or luster. Sabbatopabhanti sabbatopabhasampannam. Nibbanato hi anyo dhammo sabbatarova jyotivantarova parisuddhatarova pandaratarova natti. Sabbatopabhang means more lustrous than anything else, for there is nothing more lustrous or luminous or purer or whiter than Nibbana. In this interpretation, Nibbana is even regarded as something white in color. The etymology of the term sabbatobabang has been given a twist, for the word sabbato is taken in the comparative sense, more lustrous than anything. As we have pointed out, the term actually means lustrous on all sides. Then a second interpretation is given, bringing in the word Prabhu, Lord or Chief. Sabbatova Prabhu, that is to say, more prominent than anything else. In support of it, he says, Asukadisaya nama nimbana nadditi navantambam. It should not be said that in such and such a direction, nibbana is not to be found. He says that it is called Prabhu, or Lord, because it is to be found in all directions. Only as the third interpretation, he cites his simile of the fog, already given in his commentary to the Kevadda Sutta. What is the reason for giving so many figurative interpretations as alternatives to such a significant verse? Surely the Buddha would not have intended the verse to convey so many conflicting meanings when he preached it. No doubt the commentators have made a great effort to preserve the Dhamma, but due to some unfortunate historical circumstances, most of the deep discourses dealing with the subject of Nibbana have been handed down without even a clue into the correct version among variant meanings. This has left the commentators nonplussed, so much so that they had to give us several vague and alternative interpretations to choose from. It is up to us to decide whether we should accept this position as it is, or try to improve on it by exploring any other possible means of explanation. We had occasion to mention in our very first sermon that the Buddha himself has prophesied that those discourses which deal with voidness would, in time to come, go into disuse, with their deeper meanings obscured. The interpretations just quoted go to show that already the prediction has come true to a great extent. The phrase we quoted from the Brahmanimantanika Sutta with its reference to Anidasana Vijnana occurs in a context which has a significance of its own. The relevant paragraph therefore deserves some attention. It runs as follows. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbatubhavam tam patavina patavittena nanubhutam apasa apattena nanubhutam techasa techattena ananubhutam vayasa vayattena nanubhutam bhutanam bhutattena nanubhutam devanam divattena nanubhutam Pajapatisa pajapatitena ananubhutam, brahmanam brahmatena ananubhutam, abhasaranam abhasaratena ananubhutam, subakinhanam subakinatena ananubhutam, vyapalana vyapalatte ananubhutam, abhibhusa abhibhuttena ananubhutam, sabhasa sabhatena ananubhutam. Consciousness, which makes nothing manifest, infinite and all lustrous, it does not partake of the earthiness of earth, the wateriness of water, the fireness of fire, the airiness of air, the creaturehood of creatures, the devahood of devas, the pajapatihood of pajapati, the brahmahood of brahma, the radiance of the radiant ones, the subakinahood of the subakina brahmas, the vihappalahood of the vihappala brahmas, the overlordship of the overlord, and the allness of the all. Comment, translation by Nyanamoli. Consciousness, non-manifestating, boundless, luminous all-round, that is not partaken of by the earthness of earth, that is not partaken of by the waterness of water, etc., that is not partaken of by the allness of all. Nyanamoli, in another publication, comments on this discourse, we could take sabbatobabhang to be made of sabbato and contracted form of the present particle of pahoti, pabhavati, pahang. This ties up with the preceding sabbato abhinyaya sabba napahosi. However, the sense then required a suppressed negative, sabbato paham. The letters ha and ba are easily mistaken for each other in synonyms. In the Simonese, and this is my own comment, in the Simonese, Peters and Siamese edition, the part that precedes the reference to vijnanam anidassanam ananda sabbato paham is spoken by Brahma. It does not end with the quotative iti, nor does the quotative iti occur at the end of the present statement. Strictly speaking, it would have to be attributed to Brahma. Horner, in fact, translates the passage as something that is spoken by Brahma. Only the Burmese edition precedes this reference with iti. but it does not have an iti as the end to provide a transition to Brahma's claim that he will now disappear. So what I'm basically saying is that in the Pali editions, the non-manifestative consciousness is something spoken by Brahma, and it's only in the Burmese edition that we have an indication before the passage that it is spoken by someone else, but not at the end of the passage, which would be required, because after that Brahma continues to speak. And if we look at the parallel in the Madhyama Agama, it's definitely spoken by Brahma. And what he proclaims is, because I'm conscious of immeasurable worlds, have immeasurable knowledge, immeasurable vision, immeasurable discrimination, I know each and everything distinctly. This earth I know to be earth, water, fire, wind, etc. So in the Madhyama Agama passage, uses counterparts to Ananta repeatedly, but it has no counterpart to Anidasana or to Pabha. And this leaves open two possibilities. Either these two qualifications were lost in the Madhyama Agama, or they were added in the Majjhima Nikaya, which could have been influenced by the Kevada Sutta. The Madhyama Agama then continues with the Buddha's reply, which is, Brahma, if there is a renunciant or Brahmin who in regard to earth has a perception of earth as earth is me, earth is mine, I belong to earth, then, since he reckons earth as self, he does not truly know earth, in the same way for water, fire, etc. The implication appears to be that Brahma's claim to infinite consciousness and infinite knowledge still comes with the notion of the self, and for this reason is not true knowledge. The same sense could also be applied to the Pali version, on following the three editions which do not have iti either before or after the passage in question, thereby conveying the impression that it should be attributed to the same speaker, namely to Brahma. Understood in this sense, Brahma would claim to have an anidasana vijnana that is so aloof that it does not partake of the earthness, etc., of the various things listed. These had just before been mentioned by the Buddha as something he had direct knowledge of, yet did not take any stance in relation to earth, etc. In reply, Brahma would then take up this point by saying, Sachikote marisa sabbasa sabate nananubhutam mahevati rittakam eva ahosi tuchakam eva ahosi. If you do not partake of the allness of all, may it not be vacuous and empty for you. This would then presumably lead over to Brahma's claim regarding what indeed does not partake of the earthness, etc., allness, namely the anidasana vijnana. In order to prove the superiority of his claim, Brahma would next try to vanish from the Buddha's vision. On this alternative reading of the passage, a sense clearly supported by the Chinese, the type of consciousness described would be part of a claim by Brahma and therefore could not be related to Nibbana, contrary to what the commentaries take as. Some degree of influence by or relationship between versions of the Brahmanimantanika Sutta and the Kevada Sutta suggests itself also from the Kaivarti Sutta, the Sanskrit parallel to the Kevada Sutta, which has the reading Prithivi Prithivatenanam Vibhutam, which reminds one of the Pataviya Patavitenanam Bhutam in the Brahmanimantanika Sutta. Be that as it may, in a discussion of the passage from the Kevada Sutta, Bhikkhu Brahmari argues that due to the qualifiers Ananta and Pabha, Anidasana Vijnana is described in a way that resembles the description of certain states of Samadhi. It seems that Ananta is never used with mind or consciousness apart from describing states of Samadhi, and never seems to be used to describe the normal consciousness of the Arahant, for example. End of comment. This peculiar paragraph, listing 13 concepts, seems to convey something deep about the nature of the non-manifestative consciousness. That consciousness does not partake of the earthiness of earth, the wateriness of water, the fireiness of fire, and the airiness of air. That is to say, the nature of the four elements does not inhere in this consciousness. They do not manifest themselves in it. Similarly, the other concepts like devahood, brahmahood, etc., which the worldlings take seriously as real, have no applicability or validity here. The special significance of this assertion lies in the context in which the Buddha declared it. It is to dispel a wrong view that Bhagavata Brahma conceived in regarding his Brahma status as permanent, everlasting, and eternal. that the Buddha made this declaration before that Brahma himself in the Brahma world. The whole point of the discourse then is to challenge the wrong view of Brahma by asserting that the non-manifestative consciousness of the Arahant is above the worldly concepts of elements and divinity and the questionable reality attributed to them. In other words, they do not manifest themselves in it, they are transcended. Comment. As I mentioned already in the introduction, the salient and central point of the lectures on the Anidasana Vijnana, the non-manifestative consciousness. And based on my consultation of the parallels, I have a few points that I would like to make as a starting point for further discussion. First is that Anidasana as an epithet of Nibbana in the Asankhata Samyutta is not found in the Chinese parallel. It could result from a later expansion of the Pali lists of epithets for Nibbana. Another point is that the Anidasana Vijnana in the Brahmani Mantanika Sutta appears to be a claim made by Brahma. In that case, could not be a reference to Nibbana or a level of realization. This is definitely the case in the Chinese parallel. Another point is that the qualification of the Anidasana Vijnana in the Kivada Sutta as luminous Prabhana is less probably an original reading, as evident from a survey of parallels and quotations in later texts. In fact, the consciousness that is non-manifestative, in the sense of no vision or seeing, dasana manifesting, does not fit naturally with the presence of luminosity, at least as long as this is something visible and not just intended metaphorically. Judging from the occurrence of the Anidasana to illustrate the immaterial nature of space, an example for a state of consciousness that could be qualified as Anidasana and Ananta would even be, for example, the attainment of boundless space. The same attainment would also fit the notion of Sabbatopahana, which could refer to leaving behind all perceptions of form and of diversity, in line with what is stipulated in the standard description of the attainment of boundless space. Sammasu rupa sanyanam samadikkama, padiga sanyanam attangama, nanatta sanyanam avanasikara, ananto akasa diakasa nancha yatang upasampaja viharati. This would indeed be an experience where the four elements find no footing, but it would not be one in which name and form cease. As always suggested by Bhikkhu Brahmali, the verse in the Kevanda Sutta could be understood as providing two answers to two questions. First question, where do the four elements not get a footing? Second question, where do name and form cease? A problem is that the Pali formulation with this recurrent etta reads a bit awkward with this interpretation, and it would be more natural to read it as a single answer. This is the case for the Dirgha Agama parallel, the only version to refer to luminosity. Here it is precisely the cessation of the luminous consciousness that results in the cessation of the four elements. Another suggestion, the qualification pabhasara elsewhere in the early discourses seems to refer to experiences of concentration through absence of the hindrances, not necessarily involving insight or levels of awakening. I have surveyed this in my first book on Satipatthana. The same holds for the other qualifications of ananta, endless. Thus the condition of inner luminosity could be attained through, for example, the light kasina, which would also be an endless experience. And the last comment, whatever may be the final word on the exact implications of the introductory line Vijnana Anidasana Anandang Sabbatopahana Upabhang, the main import of the Kivanda Sutta seems to be that the monk was mistaken in searching in the heavens for a location where the four elements cease. The Buddha clarified that the inquiry should rather be where the four elements do not find a footing, and where dualistic concepts usually apply to matter, length and short, etc., cease. This takes place when, with the cessation of consciousness, name and form cease. The journey of the monk through heavenly realms, presumably representative of meditative cultivation leading up to deep concentration, did not lead him to the final goal. The Buddha clarifies that this requires the experience of the cessation aspect of dependent arising, in particular the cessation of consciousness and name and form. Yes, and here's just bibliographical information for all the different academics I quoted, except for the standard translation of the Pali Discourses. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'm very curious to see what the points that have come up with this sermon and my comments will raise in terms of the discussion on the forum.